He appeared grave, almost angry with her as they parted. Later, when he had walked her home, she turned before going down the basement steps and saw he was still standing there. He gave her a grin that reminded her so much of his brother Frank's way of grinning, so full of mischief and innocence, that she laughed and pointed at him in mock accusation. It was clear, once she arrived in the kitchen and was waiting for the kettle to boil, that Mrs. Kehoe, who was alone at the table, was not speaking to her. She felt a lightness that almost caused her to ask Mrs. Kehoe what the problem was, but instead she moved around the kitchen pretending that she noticed nothing strange. It struck her then that Mrs. Kehoe, who generally, Eilish believed, heard every sound and missed nothing, had heard Tony either entering or leaving the basement, or, perhaps worse indeed, heard him during the night. In all the outrages that could be committed by the lodgers, this had never even been mentioned as a possibility by the lodgers themselves or by Mrs. Kehoe. It was in the realm of the unthinkable. While Patty and Diana often talked freely about boyfriends, the idea that one of them would spend an entire night in the company of her boyfriend or allow him access to her bedroom was out of the question. As Eilish sat in the chilly silence created by Mrs. Kehoe, she determined to deny, emphatically and brazenly, that Tony had been near her room and declare that such an idea shocked her as much as it did her landlady. She made poached eggs and toast and was relieved when Patty and Diana came in with news about a coat that Patty had seen and was going to buy if it was still there on Friday when she got paid. Mrs. Kehoe stood up without speaking and left the kitchen banging the door. "What's biting her?" Patty asked. "I think I know," Diana said, looking at Eilish. "But as God is my witness, I heard nothing."
"Heard what?"
Patty asked.
"Nothing,"
Diana said. "But it sounded lovely." Eilish slept deeply and woke in the morning exhausted and sore. It was as though Rose's death had happened long ago, and her night with Tony remained with her as something powerful, still present. She wondered how she would know if she was pregnant, how early the signs would come. She touched her stomach, asking herself if at this very moment something could be happening there, some tiny connection like a small knot, or smaller even, smaller than a drop of water, but with everything in it that was needed for it to grow. She wondered if there was anything she could do to stop it, if there was something she could wash herself with. But as soon as she thought of that, she knew that even the idea was wrong, and that she would have to go to confession and make Tony go too. She hoped that he would not grin at her again as he had done the previous evening, and that he would realize the trouble she was in if she was pregnant. But if she was not pregnant, she hoped he would understand, as she did now, that what they had done was wrong, and more wrong because it had been done when Rose was barely in her grave. Even when she went to confession, Eilish realized, and told the priest what they had done, she would never be able to tell anyone that just half an hour before they had been crying. It would seem too strange. As soon as she saw Tony that evening, she told him that they would both have to go to confession the following evening, which was Friday, and that she presumed he understood this. "I couldn't go to Father Flood," she said, "or any priest who might recognize me. I know it shouldn't matter, but I couldn't." Tony suggested that they should go to his local church, where most of the priests were Italians. "Some of them don't understand a word you're saying if you speak in English," he said.
"That's not a real confession, then?"
"But I think they recognize some key words."
"Don't make jokes. You are going to confession, too."
"I know that," he said. "And will you promise me something?" He moved close to her. "Will you promise to be kind to me after the confession? I mean to hold my hand and talk to me and smile."
"And will you promise me to make a good confession?"
"Yes, I will," he said. "And my mom wants you to come to lunch on Sunday. She's worried about you." The following evening they met outside his church. Tony insisted that they go to separate priests. Hers, he said, a priest called Anthony with a long Italian surname, was young and nice and spoke English. He himself, he said, was going to go to one of the older Italian ones.
"Make sure he understands what you say," she whispered.
When she told the priest she had had sexual intercourse twice with her boyfriend 3 nights earlier, he left silence for a long time.
"Was this the first time?"
he asked when he spoke eventually.
"Yes, Father."
"Do you love one another?"
"Yes, Father."
What will you do if you are pregnant?
He will want to marry me, father.
Do you want to marry him?
She could not answer. After a while, he asked her again, his tone sympathetic. I would like to marry him, she said hesitantly, but I am not ready to marry him now.
But you say you love him.
He is a good man.
Is that enough?
I love him.
But you are not sure.
She sighed and said nothing.
Are you sorry for what you did with him?
Yes, father.
For your penance, I want you to say just one Hail Mary, but say it slowly and think about the words, and you must promise to come back in 1 month. If you were pregnant, we will have to talk again, and we will help you in every way we can.
When she got back to Mrs. Kehoe's, she discovered that a lock had been put on the basement gate, and she had to let herself in by the main door. Mrs. Kehoe was in the kitchen with Miss McAdam, who had decided that she was not going to the dance.
I'm going to keep the basement locked in future, Mrs. Kehoe said as though speaking to Miss McAdam alone. You wouldn't know who would be going down there.
You are very wise, Miss McAdam said.
As Eilish made her supper, Mrs. Kehoe and Miss McAdam treated her as though she were a ghost. Eilish's mother wrote and mentioned how lonely she was, and how long the day was, and how hard the night. She said that neighbors looked in on her all the time, and people called after tea, but she had run out of things to say to them. Eilish wrote to her a number of times. She told her mother all the news about the summer styles in Bartocci's and other stores on Fulton Street, and about preparing for her exams, which would come in May, saying she was studying hard because if she passed, she would be a qualified bookkeeper. She never mentioned Tony in any of her letters home, and she wondered if, by now, her mother, in clearing out Rose's room or in receiving what was in her desk at the office, had found and read her letters to Rose. She saw Tony every day, sometimes merely meeting him outside the college and traveling with him on the trolley car and letting him walk her as far as Mrs. Kehoe's. Since the night he had spent in her room, everything was different between them. She felt that he was more relaxed, more willing to be silent and not trying to impress her so much or make jokes. And every time she saw him waiting for her, she felt that they had become closer. Every time they kissed or even brushed against each other as they walked along the street, she was reminded of the night they had been together. Once she discovered that she was not pregnant, she thought of the night with pleasure, especially after she had returned to the priest, who somehow managed to imply that what had happened between her and Tony was not hard to understand, despite the fact that it was wrong, and was maybe a sign from God that they should consider getting married and raising a family. He seemed so easy to talk to the second time that she was tempted to tell him the whole story and ask him what she should do about her mother, whose letters to her were increasingly sad, the handwriting at times wandering strangely across the page, almost illegible, but she left the confession box without saying anything more. One Sunday after Mass, as she was walking out of the church with Sheila Heffernan, Eilish noticed that Father Flood, who often stood in front of the church after Mass greeting his parishioners, had averted his eyes and moved into the shadows when they approached, and was soon speaking to a number of women with immense concentration. She waited behind only to find that the priest, having spotted her, turned his back and walked away from her quickly. It occurred to her immediately that Mrs. Kehoe had spoken to him, and that she should go to see him as soon as possible before he did something unthinkable, such as write to her mother about her, although she had no idea what she would say to him. Thus, after lunch with Tony and his family, she made an arrangement to see Tony later, but said that she had to go now and study. She refused to allow him to come on the subway with her. She went straight from the subway station to Father Flood's house. It was only when she was sitting in the front parlor waiting for him that it struck her that she could not easily mention Mrs. Kehoe. She would have to wait for him to do so. If he did not raise the subject, she thought, she could talk about her mother, and maybe even discuss the possibility of moving into the office at Bertocci's, were a vacancy to arise after she passed her bookkeeping exams. As she heard footsteps approaching in the hallway, she knew she had a choice. She could appear humble before him and imply an abject apology, even if she did not admit everything, or she could model herself on Rose, stand up now as Rose might have, and speak to Father Flood as though she were entirely incapable of any wrongdoing. Father Flood seemed uneasy when he came into the room and did not immediately catch her eye.
I hope I am not disturbing you now, Father, she said.
Oh, no, not at all. I was just reading the paper. She knew that it was important to speak now before he did.
I don't know if you've heard from my mother, but I've had letters, and she seems not to be well at all.
I'm sorry to hear that, Father Flood said. You know, I did think it must be hard for her. Whatever way he looked at her, he managed to let her know that he meant more than he said, that he was suggesting it might be hard for her mother not only losing Rose, but having a daughter who would take a man home to a room for the night. Eilish now held his gaze and left enough silence for him to know that she had understood the implications of his words, but had no intention of giving them any further consideration.
As you know, I hope to get my exams next month, and this would mean that I would be a qualified bookkeeper. I have some money saved, and I thought I might go home, just to see my mother, for as long as Bartocci's would let me have unpaid leave. Also, like many of the other lodgers, I have been having difficulty with Mrs. Kehoe, and when I come back from Ireland I might consider change in my lodgings.
She's very nice, Mrs. Kehoe, Father Flood said. There aren't many Irish places like that now. In the old days there used to be more.
Eilish did not reply.
So, you want me to talk to Bartocci? He asked. How long would you like to go for?
A month, Eilish said.
And would you like to come back and work on the shop floor until a job in the office came up?
Yes.
He nodded his head and seemed to be thinking about something.
Would you like me to talk to Mrs. Kehoe as well?
He asked.
I thought you already had.
Not since Rose died, Father Flood said. I'm not sure I have seen her since then.
Eilish studied his face, but she could not tell whether it was true or not.
Would you not make it up with her? Father Flood asked.
How would I do that?
She's very fond of you.
Eilish said nothing.
I'll tell you what, Father Flood said. I'll square Bartocci if you make it up with Ma Kehoe.
How would I do that? She repeated.
Be nice to her.
Before she had seen Father Flood, it had not occurred to Eilish that she might go home for a brief stay. But once it had been said, and did not sound ridiculous, and had met with Father Flood's approval, then it became a plan, something that she was determined to do. At lunchtime the following day she went to a travel agent and found prices for liners crossing the Atlantic. She would wait until her exam results came out, but once she knew them she would go home for a month. It would take 5 or 6 days each way, so she would have 2.5 weeks with her mother. Although she wrote to her mother later that week, she did not mention anything about her plans to go home. When she saw Father Flood in the department store one day, she knew that he was there on her behalf, because he winked at her as he passed, and she hoped he would have news for her soon. On Friday, when Tony had walked her home after the dance, she found a letter from Father Flood that had been delivered by hand. Mrs. Kehoe soon arrived into the kitchen to announce that she was about to make tea and that she hoped Eilish would join her. Eilish smiled warmly at Mrs. Kehoe and said that she would love that, and then went to her room and opened the letter. The Bartucci's, Father Flood said, could offer her 1 month's unpaid leave, the date to be arranged with Miss Fortini, and, if she passed her exams, they hoped they could offer her a job in the office over the next 6 months. She left the letter on the bed and went upstairs to find her tea almost poured. "Would you feel safe if I took the lock off the basement gate?" Mrs. Kehoe asked her. "I didn't know what to do, so I asked that nice Sergeant Mulhall, whose wife plays poker with me, and he said that he would have his officers keep a special watch on it and report any untoward activity down there."
"Oh, that's a great idea, Mrs. Kehoe," Eilish said. "You should thank him on behalf of all of us the next time you see him."
She hoped that the law exam would be as easy as the last time, and she was happy with the work she had done in all the other subjects. As part of the final exam, however, every student would be given all the details of the annual life of a company, rent and heat and light, wages, the fact that machinery and other assets might devalue each year, debt, capital investment, and tax. On the other side, there would be sales, money coming in from a number of sources, be they wholesale or retail. And all of this would have to be entered into ledgers in the correct column. It would have to be done neatly, so that at an annual general meeting, when the board and shareholders of a company wanted to see clearly how profit or loss had been made, they could do so from these ledgers. Anyone who failed this part of the exam, they were told, would not get a passing mark, even if they did well in other papers. They would have to repeat the entire exam. One evening, close to the exams, when Tony was walking her home, Eilish told him about her plan to go home for a month once the results came.
She had already written to her mother, telling her the news. Tony said nothing to her, but when they arrived at Mrs. Kehoe's, he asked her to walk with him around the block. His face was pale, and he seemed serious and did not look at her directly as he spoke. When they were away from Mrs. Kehoe's, he sat on a stoop where there was no one, leaving her standing against the railings. She knew that he would be upset about her going like this, but was ready to explain to him that he had family in Brooklyn and did not know what it was like to be away from home. She was prepared to tell him that he would go home too for a visit under similar circumstances.
"Marry me before you go back," he said, almost under his breath.
"What did you say?"
She went to the stoop and sat beside him.
"If you go, you won't come back."
"I'm just going for a month, I told you."
"Marry me before you go back."
"You don't trust me to come back."
"I read the letter your brother wrote. I know how hard it would be for you to go home and then leave again. I know it would be hard for me. I know what a good person you are. I would live in fear of getting a letter from you explaining that your mother could not be left alone.
I promise you I will come back."
Each time he said marry me, he looked away from her, mumbling the words as though he were talking to himself. Now he turned and looked at her clearly. "I don't mean in a church, and I don't mean we live together as man and wife, and we don't have to tell anybody. It can be just between the two of us, and we can get married in a church when we decide after you come back."
"Can you get married just like that?"
she asked.
"Sure you can.
You have to give them notice, and I'll get a list of things we need to do."
"Why do you want me to do it?"
"It will just be something between us."
"But why do you want it?"
When he spoke now, he had tears in his eyes.
"Because if we don't do it, I'm going to go crazy."
"And we'll tell no one?"
"No one.
We'll take a half day off work, that's all."
"And will I wear a ring?"
"You can if you want, but if you don't, that's fine. All this could, if you wanted, be just something private between the two of us."
"Would a promise not be the same?"
"If you can promise, then you can easily do this," he said. He arranged a date soon after her exams, and they set about making all the preparations and filling out the forms that were required. The Sunday before the date, she went, as usual, to his family for lunch. As she sat down, she felt that Tony had told his mother, or that his mother had guessed something. There was a new tablecloth on the table, and the way his mother was dressed suggested an important occasion. Then, when Tony's father came in with his three brothers, she saw that they were all wearing jackets and ties, which they did not normally do. Once they sat down to eat, she noticed that Frank was unusually quiet at the beginning, and then every time he tried to speak, the others interrupted him before he could start. Several times more, in the course of the meal, when he opened his mouth to say something, he was stopped. Eventually, Eilish insisted that she needed to hear what he had to say.
"When we're all living in Long Island," he said, "and when you have your house there, will you make them build me a room so I can come and stay with you when they're all making me miserable?"
Tony, Eilish saw, had his head down.
"Of course, Frank, and you will be able to come any time you like. That's all I wanted to say."
"Grow up, Frank," Tony said. "Grow up, Frank,"
Lawrence repeated.
"Yeah, Frank," Maurice added.
"See?"
Frank motioned to Eilish and pointed at his three brothers.
"That is what I have to tolerate."
"Don't worry," Eilish said. "I'll deal with them." At the end of the meal, as the dessert was served, Tony's father produced special glasses and opened a bottle of Prosecco. He proposed that they drink for a safe journey and a safe return for Eilish. She wondered if it was still possible that Tony had told them nothing about the wedding, just about her plans to go home for a month. It struck her as unlikely that he would have let Frank know, unless Frank had overheard. Maybe they were just having a special lunch because she was going home, she thought. In the good cheer that followed the dessert, she almost began to hope that he had told them that he and she were getting married. He arranged the ceremony for 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a week before she was to leave. The exams had gone well, and she was almost certain that she would qualify. Because other couples to be married came with family and friends, their ceremony seemed brisk and over quickly, and caused much curiosity among those waiting because they had come alone. On their journey to Coney Island on the train that afternoon, Tony raised the question for the first time of when they might marry in church and live together. "I have money saved," he said, "so we could get an apartment and then move to the house when it's ready."
I don't mind, she said. I wish we were going home together now.
He touched her hand.
So do I, he said. And the ring looks great on your finger.
She looked down at the ring.
I'd better remember to take it off before Mrs. Kehoe sees it.
The ocean was rough and grey, and the wind blew white billowing clouds quickly across the sky. They moved slowly along the boardwalk and down the pier, where they stood watching the fishermen. As they walked back and sat eating hot dogs at Nathan's, Eilish spotted someone at the next table checking out her wedding ring. She smiled to herself.
Will we ever tell our children that we did this? She asked.
When we are old, maybe, and have run out of other stories, Tony said. Or maybe we'll save it up for some anniversary.
I wonder what they'll think of it.
The movie I'm taking you to was called The Belle of New York. They'll believe that bit. But the idea that, when the movie was over, we took the subway home and I dropped you off at Mrs. Kehoe's, they won't believe that.
When they finished eating, they walked together towards the subway and waited for the train to take them into the city. Part 4. Her mother showed Eilish Rose's bedroom, which was filled with light from the morning sun. She had left everything, she said, exactly as it was, including all of Rose's clothes in the wardrobe and in the chest of drawers. I had the windows cleaned and the curtains washed, and I dusted the room myself and swept it out. But other than that, it's exactly the same, her mother said. The house itself did not seem strange. Eilish noted only its solid, familiar aura, the lingering smell of cooked food, the shadows, the sense of her mother's vivid presence. But nothing had prepared her for the quietness of Rose's bedroom, and she felt almost nothing as she stood looking at it. She wondered if her mother wanted her to cry now, or had left the room as it was so she could feel even more deeply Rose's death. She did not know what to say.
And some day now, her mother said, we can go through the clothes. Rose had just bought a new winter coat, and we'll see if it suits you. She had lovely things.
Eilish suddenly felt immensely tired, and thought that she should go to bed once they had eaten breakfast, but she knew that her mother had been planning this moment when they would both stand in this doorway together and contemplate the room.
You know, I sometimes think she's still alive, her mother said. If I hear the slightest sound upstairs, I often think it must be Rose.
As they ate breakfast, Eilish wished she could think of something more to say, but it was hard to speak, since her mother seemed to have prepared in advance every word that she said.
I have arranged a wreath to be made specially for you to leave on her grave, and we can go out in a few days if the weather keeps up, and then we can let them know it's time to put Rose's name and her dates below your father's.
Eilish wondered for a moment what might happen were she to interrupt her mother and say, I am married. She thought her mother would have a way of not hearing her, or of pretending that she had not spoken. Or else, she imagined, the glass in the window might break. By the time she managed to say that she was tired and would need to lie down for a while, her mother had not asked her one question about her time in America, or even her trip home. Just as her mother seemed to have prepared things to say and show to her, Eilish had been planning how this first day would go. She had planned to give an account of how much more smooth the crossing from New York to Cove had been than her first voyage from Liverpool, and how much she had enjoyed sitting up on deck taking in the sun. She had planned also to show her mother the letter from Brooklyn College, telling her that she had passed her exams and would, in time, be sent a certificate to say that she was a qualified bookkeeper. She had also bought her mother a cardigan and scarf and some stockings, but her mother had almost absent-mindedly left them aside, saying that she would open them later. Eilish loved closing the door of her old room and drawing the curtains. All she wanted to do was sleep, even though she had slept well in the hotel in Rosslare Harbor the night before. She had sent Tony a postcard from Cove saying she had arrived safely, and had written him a letter from Rosslare describing the journey. She was glad she did not have to write now from her bedroom, which seemed empty of life, which almost frightened her in how little it meant to her. She had put no thought into what it would be like to come home, because she had expected that it would be easy. She had longed so much for the familiarity of these rooms that she had presumed she would be happy and relieved to step back into them. But instead, on this first morning, all she could do was count the days before she went back. This made her feel strange and guilty. She curled up in the bed and closed her eyes in the hope that she might sleep. Her mother woke her, saying it was almost tea time. She had slept, she guessed, for almost 6 hours, and wanted nothing more than to go back to sleep. Her mother told her that there was hot water in case she wanted a bath. She opened her suitcases and began to hang clothes in the wardrobe and store other things in the chest of drawers. She found a summer dress that did not seem to be too wrinkled, and a cardigan and clean underwear and a pair of flat shoes. When she came back into the kitchen, having had her bath and put on the fresh clothes, her mother looked her up and down in vague disapproval. It struck Eilish that maybe the colors she was wearing were too bright, but she did not have any darker colors.
"Now the whole town has been asking for you," her mother said. "God, even Nellie Kelly was asking for you. I saw her standing at the door of the shop, and she let a big roar at me. And all your friends want you to call around, but I told them that it would be better to wait until you are settled."
Eilish wondered if her mother had always had this way of speaking that seemed to welcome no reply, and suddenly realized that she had seldom been alone with her before. She had always had Rose to stand between her and her mother. Rose, who would have plenty to say to both of them, questions to ask, comments to make, and opinions to offer. It must be hard for her mother, too, she thought, and it would be best to wait a few days and see if her mother might become interested in her life in America, enough for her slowly to introduce the subject of Tony, enough for her to tell her mother that she was going to marry him when she went back. They sat at the dining-room table, going through all the letters of condolence and mass cards they had received in the weeks after Rose died. Eilish's mother had had a memorial card printed with a photograph of Rose at her most glamorous and happy, giving her name and her age and the date of her death, with short prayers below and on the other side of the card. These had to be sent out. But also, to those who had written letters or those who had visited the house, special notes or longer letters had to be included. Eilish's mother had divided the memorial cards into three piles, one that needed just a name and address on the envelope and a card enclosed, the second requiring a note or a letter from her, and the last needing Eilish to write a note or a letter. Eilish remembered vaguely that this had happened too after her father died, but Rose, she recalled, had taken care of everything, and she had not been actively involved. Her mother knew some of the letters of condolence she had received almost by heart, and had also a list of everyone who had called to the house, which she went through slowly for Eilish, remarking on some who had come too often or stayed too long, or others who had gossiped too much or given offense by something they had said. And there were cousins of her mother from out beyond Bree who had brought neighbors of theirs, rough people from out the country, to the house, and she hoped never to lay eyes on either the cousins or their neighbors again. Then, she said, Dora Devereaux from Cush Gap and her sister Stacia had come one night, and they had never stopped talking, the two of them, with news about people no one else in the room had ever heard of. They had left a mass card each, her mother said, and she would write them a short note thanking them for their visit, but trying not to encourage them to call again in a hurry. But Nora Webster had come, she said, with Michael, who had taught the boys in school, and they were the nicest people in the whole town. She wouldn't mind, she said, if they came again, but as they had young children, she didn't think they would. As her mother read out lists of other people, Eilish was almost inclined to giggle at names she had not heard of or thought of during her time in America. When her mother mentioned an old woman who lived down near the Folly, Eilish could not resist speaking, "God, is she still going?" Her mother looked sorrowful and put on her glasses again, and she began to search for a letter she had mislaid from the captain of the golf club, saying what a treasured lady member Rose had been and how much she would be missed. When she found it, she looked at Eilish severely. Every letter or note Eilish wrote had to be inspected by her mother, who often wanted it done again or a paragraph added at the end. And in her own letters, as in Eilish's, she wanted it emphasized that, since Eilish was home, she had plenty of company and needed no more visitors. Eilish marveled at the different ways each person had expressed condolences once they had gone beyond the first one or two sentences. Her mother tried, too, in how she replied, to vary the tone and the content, to write something suitable in response to each person. But it was slow, and by the end of the first day, Eilish had still not gone out into the street or had any time alone, and less than half the work was done. The following day she worked hard, saying to her mother a number of times that if they continued talking or going over each letter received, they would never complete the task in front of them. Yet not only did her mother work slowly, insisting that she and not Eilish would have to write most of the letters, but wanting Eilish to look at each one she completed, But also she could not resist making regular comments on those who had written, including people Eilish had never met. Eilish tried to change the subject a few times, wondering to her mother if they might go to Dublin together some day, or even go to Wexford on the train some afternoon. But her mother said that they would wait and see. The thing was to get these letters written and sent, and then they would go through Rose's room and sort out her clothes. As they had their tea on the second day, Eilish told her mother that if she did not contact some of her friends soon, they would be insulted. Now that she had begun, she was determined to win a free day, not to have to go straight from writing letters and addressing envelopes under her mother's sharp and increasingly cranky supervision to sorting out Rose's clothes. "I arranged for the wreath to be delivered tomorrow," her mother said, "so that's our day for the graveyard." "Yes, well, I'll see Annette and Nancy tomorrow evening, then," Eilish said.
"You know, they called around asking when you were coming back. I put them off, but if you want to see them, then you should invite them here."
"Maybe I'll do that now," Eilish said. "If I leave a note for Nancy, then she can get in touch with Annette. Is Nancy still going out with George? She said they were getting engaged."
"I'll let her give you all the news," her mother said and smiled.
"George would be a great catch," Eilish said, "and he's good-looking as well."
"Oh, I don't know," her mother said. "They could make a slave out of her in that shop, and that old Mrs. Sheridan is very noble. I wouldn't have any time for her at all."
Walking out into the street brought Eilish instant relief, and, as it was a beautiful warm evening, she could happily have walked for miles. She noticed a woman studying her dress and her stockings and her shoes, and then her tanned skin, and she realized with amusement as she moved towards Nancy's house that she must look glamorous in these streets. She touched her finger where the wedding ring had been and promised herself that she would write to Tony that evening when her mother had gone to bed and work out a way of posting her letter in the morning without her mother knowing. Or maybe, she thought, it would be a good way of letting her mother gently into the secret, in case she had not seen the letters that Eilish had written to Rose, that there was someone special for her in America. The next day, as they walked out to the graveyard with the wreath, anyone they met whom they knew stopped to talk. They complimented Eilish on how well she looked, but did not do so too effusively or in too frivolous a tone, because they could see that she was on her way with her mother to her sister's grave. It was only as they walked up through the main avenue of the graveyard towards the family plot that Eilish fully understood the extent to which she had been dreading this. She felt sorry for how much she had been irritated by her mother over the previous days, and now walked slowly, linking her arm while carrying the wreath. A few people in the graveyard stood and watched as they approached the grave. There was another wreath, almost withered, that her mother removed, and then she stood back beside Eilish, facing the headstone. "So, Rose," her mother said quietly, "here's Eilish. She's home now, and we've brought fresh flowers out to you." Eilish did not know if her mother expected her to say something too, but since she was crying now, she was not sure she could make herself clear. She held her mother's hand.
"I'm praying for you, Rose, and thinking about you," Eilish whispered, "and I hope you're praying for me."
"She's praying for all of us," her mother said. "Rose is up in heaven praying for all of us."
As they stood there silently at the grave, Eilish found the idea that Rose was below the earth, surrounded by darkness, almost impossible to bear. She tried to think about her sister when she was alive, the light in her eyes, her voice, her way of putting a cardigan over her shoulders if she felt a draft, her way of handling their mother, making her interested in even the smallest detail of Rose's and Eilish's lives, as though she too had the same friends, the same interests, the same experiences. Eilish concentrated on Rose's spirit and tried to keep her mind from dwelling on what was happening to Rose's body just beneath them in the damp clay. They walked home by Summerhill and then past the fair green to the back road because her mother said that she did not want to meet anybody else that day. But it occurred to Eilish that she did not want anyone to see Eilish who might invite her out or cause her to leave her mother's side at any point. That evening, when Nancy and Annette called, Eilish noticed Nancy's engagement ring immediately. Nancy explained that she had been engaged to George for 2 months now, but she hadn't wanted to write to Eilish about it because of Rose.
"But it's great you'll be here for the wedding. Your mother is delighted."
"When's the wedding?"
"On Saturday, the 27th of June.
"But I'll be gone back," Eilish said.
"Your mother said you'll still be here. She wrote and accepted the invitation on behalf of the two of you."
Her mother came into the room with a tray and cups and saucers and a teapot and some cakes.
"There you are now," she said. "It's lovely to see you both. A bit of life in the house again. Poor Eilish was fed up with her old mother. And we're looking forward to the wedding, Nancy. We'll have to get the best of style for it. That's what Rose would want."
She left the room before any of them could speak. Nancy looked at Eilish and shrugged.
"You'll have to come now."
Eilish worked out in her head that the wedding was 4 days after the planned date of her departure. She also remembered that the travel agent in Brooklyn had said she could change the date as long as she notified the shipping company in advance. She decided there and then that she would stay an extra week and hoped that no one in Bartocci's would object too strongly. It would be easy to explain to Tony that her mother had misunderstood her date of departure, even though Eilish did not believe that her mother had misunderstood anything.
"Or maybe you have someone waiting impatiently for you in New York," Annette suggested.
"Such as Mrs. Kehoe, my landlady," Eilish replied.
She knew that she could not trust herself to begin to confide in either of her friends, especially when they were together like this, without letting them know too much. And if she told them, she would soon find that one of their mothers would mention to her mother that Eilish had a boyfriend in New York. It was best, she thought, to say nothing, to talk instead about clothes and her studies, and tell them about the other lodgers and Mrs. Kehoe. They, in turn, told her the news from the town, who was going out with whom, or who was planning to get engaged, adding that the freshest news was that Nancy's sister, who had been going out with Jim Farrell on and off since Christmas, had finally broken it off with him and had a new boyfriend who was from Ferns.
"She only got off with Jim Farrell as a dare," Nancy said. "He was being as rude to her as he was to you that night. Do you remember how rude he was? And we all bet money that she wouldn't get off with him. And then she did. But she couldn't bear him in the end. She said he was a terrible pain in the neck, even though George says he's really a nice fella if you get to know him. And George was in school with him."
"George is very charitable," Annette said.
Jim Farrell, Nancy said, was coming to the wedding as a friend of George, but her sister was demanding that her new boyfriend from Ferns also be invited. In all this talk of boyfriends and plans for the wedding, Eilish realized that if she were to tell Nancy or Annette about her own secret wedding, attended by no one except her and Tony, they would respond with silence and bewilderment. It would seem too strange. For the next few days, as she moved around the town, and on Sunday, when she went to 11 o'clock Mass with her mother, people commented on Eilish's beautiful clothes, her sophisticated hairstyle, and her suntan. She tried to make plans to see Annette or Nancy either together or separately every day, telling her mother in advance what she intended to do. On the following Wednesday, when she told her mother that, if it was fine, she was going the next day in the early afternoon to Curlicloe with George Sheridan and Nancy and Annette, her mother demanded that she cancel her outing that evening and begin the task of going through Rose's belongings, deciding what to keep and what to give away. They took out the clothes hanging in the wardrobe and put them on the bed. Eilish wanted to make clear that she did not need any of her sister's clothes and that it would be best to give away everything to a charity. But her mother was already setting aside Rose's winter coat, so recently acquired, and a number of frocks that she said could easily be altered to fit Eilish.
"I won't have much room in my suitcase," Eilish said, "and the coat is lovely, but the color is too dark for me."
Her mother, still busy sorting the clothes, pretended that she had not heard her. "What we'll do is we'll take the frocks and the coat to the dressmakers in the morning, and they'll look different when they are the proper size, when they match your new American figure." Eilish, in turn, began to ignore her mother as she opened the bottom drawer of the chest and poured its contents onto the floor. She wanted to make sure that she found her letters to Rose, if they were here, before her mother did. There were old medals and brochures, even hairnets and hairpins which had not been used for years, and folded handkerchiefs, and some photographs that Eilish put aside, as well as a large number of scorecards for golf. But there was no sign in this drawer, or in any of the others, of the letters.
"Most of this is rubbish, Mammy," she said. "It'll be best to just keep the photographs and throw the rest away."
"Oh, I'll need to look at all that. But come over here now and help me fold these scarves."
Eilish refused to go to the dressmaker's the following morning, telling her mother finally and emphatically that she did not want to wear any of Rose's frocks or coats, no matter how elegant they were or how much they cost.
"Do you want me to dump them, then?
There are a lot of people would love them,
but they are not good enough for you."
"I have my own clothes."
"Well, I'll leave them in the wardrobe in case you change your mind.
You could give them away and then find someone you didn't know at Mass on Sunday wearing them. That'd be nice now.
In the post office, Eilish had bought enough stamps and special envelopes for letters to America. She wrote to Tony explaining that she was staying a few weeks extra, and to the shipping company at the office in Cove, cancelling the return passage she had booked, and asking them to let her know how to arrange a later date for her return. She thought that she would wait until closer to the date to alert Miss Fortini and Mrs. Kehoe to her late arrival. She wondered if it would be wise to use illness as an excuse. She told Tony about the visit to Rose's grave and about Nancy's engagement, assuring him that she kept his ring close to her so that she could think about him when she was alone. At lunchtime, she put a towel and her bathing costume and a pair of sandals into a bag and walked to Nancy's house, where George Sheridan was going to collect them. It had been a beautiful morning, the air sweet and still, and it was hot, almost stifling in the house as they waited for George to arrive. When they heard the sound of the horn beeping in the station wagon he used to make deliveries, they went outside. Eilish was surprised to see Jim Farrell as he held the door open for her, and then got in beside her, allowing Nancy to sit beside George in the front passenger seat. Eilish nodded coldly at Jim and sat as far away from him as she could. She had spotted him at Mass the previous Sunday, but had been careful to avoid him. As they moved out of the town, she realized that he, and not Annette, was coming with them. She was angry with Nancy for not having told her. She would have canceled had she known. She was further infuriated when George and Jim began a discussion about some rugby game as the car made its way along the Osborne Road towards Vinegar Hill and then turned right towards Curlicloe. She thought for a moment of interrupting the two men to tell them that in Brooklyn there was a Vinegar Hill too, but that it was nothing like the Vinegar Hill that overlooked Enniscorthy, even though it was called after it. Anything, she thought, to shut them up. Instead, she decided that she would not speak once to Jim Farrell, not even acknowledge his presence, and that as soon as there was a gap in the conversation, she would introduce a topic on which he could not contribute. When George had parked the car, and George and Nancy moved ahead towards the boardwalk that led over the sand dunes to the beach, Jim Farrell spoke to her very quietly, asking her mother was, saying that he and his mother and father had been to Rose's funeral mass. His mother, he said, had been very fond of her in the golf club. "All in all," he said, "it was the saddest thing that has happened in the town for a long time." She nodded. If he wanted her to think well of him, she thought, then she would let him know as soon as possible that she had no intention of doing so. But this was hardly the moment. "It must be difficult being home," he said, "although it must be nice for your mother." She turned and smiled sadly at him. They did not speak again until they reached the Strand and caught up with George and Nancy. Jim, it turned out, had not brought a towel or his togs, and said that the water was, in any case, probably too cold. Eilish looked at Nancy and then shot a withering glance at Jim for Nancy to witness. As Jim removed his shoes and socks and rolled up the bottoms of his trousers and went down to the water, the other three began to change. If this had been years ago, Eilish thought, she would have worried during the entire journey from Enniscorthy about her swimsuit and its style, about whether she was too unshapely or awkward on the beach, or what George and Jim would think of her. But now, however, that she was still suntanned from the boat and from her trips to Coney Island with Tony, she felt oddly confident as she walked down the Strand, passing Jim Farrell paddling at the edge of the water without saying a word to him, wading out and then, as the first high wave approached, swimming into it as it broke and then out beyond it. She knew he was watching her, and the idea that she should really have splashed him as she passed him made her smile. For a second it came into her mind as something she could tell Rose and that Rose would love. But then she realized with a sense of regret close to an actual pain that Rose was dead, and there were things like this, ordinary things, that she would never know. It would not matter to her now. Later, Nancy and George walked together towards Ballyconegar, leaving Eilish and Jim to follow. Jim began to ask her questions about America. He said he had two uncles in New York, and he used to imagine them among the skyscrapers of Manhattan until he found out that they were 200 miles from New York City. It was in New York State, he said, and the village one of them was in was smaller than Bunclody. When she told him that a priest, who had been a friend of her sister, had encouraged her to go and helped her there, he asked her the name of the priest. When she said Father Flood, she was taken aback for a moment when Jim Farrell said that his parents knew him well. His father, he thought, had been in St. Peter's College with him. Later, they drove to Wexford and had their tea in the Talbot Hotel, where the wedding party was going to be held. When they got back to Enniscorthy, Jim invited them to have a drink in his father's pub before going home. His mother, who was serving behind the bar, knew all about their outing and greeted Eilish with an effusive warmth that Eilish found almost unsettling. Before they parted, they agreed that they would repeat the outing the following Sunday. George mentioned the possibility of going from Curlicloe to the dance in Coretown. Eilish had no key to the front door of the house in Frary Street, so she had to knock. She hoped that her mother was not asleep. She could hear her coming slowly to answer the door and thought she must have been in the kitchen. Her mother spent some time opening locks and pulling back bolts.
"Well, here you are," her mother said and smiled. "I'll have to get you a key."
"I hope I didn't wake you."
"No. When I saw you going off, I thought to myself that you'd be back late. But it isn't that late, because there's still a bit of light in the sky."
Her mother closed the door and led her towards the kitchen.
"Now tell me something," she said. "Did you have a great outing?"
"It was nice, Mammy. And we went to Wexford for our tea."
"And I hope that Jim Ferrell wasn't too ignorant?"
"He was fine, minding his manners."
"Well, the big news is that Davis's office is sent up for you, and they have a crisis because all the lorry drivers have to be paid tomorrow, and so do all the men working in the mill, and one girl is on her holidays, and Alice Roche is sick, and they were at their wits' end when someone thought of you. And they want you to be there at 9:30 in the morning, and I said you would be. It was better to say yes than no."
"How did they know I was here?"
"Sure, the whole town knows you're here. So I'll have your breakfast on the table at 8:30, and you'd better wear sensible clothes. Nothing too American now."
Her mother had a smile of satisfaction on her face, and this came as a relief to Eilish, who had, over the previous days, begun to dread the silences between them, and resent her mother's lack of interest in discussing anything, any single detail about her time in America. They spoke now in the kitchen about Nancy and George and the wedding, and arranged to go to Dublin the following Tuesday to buy an outfit for the day. They discussed what they should buy Nancy as a wedding present. When Eilish went upstairs, she felt, for the first time, less uneasy about being home, and found that she was almost looking forward to the day dealing with wages at Davis's, and then the weekend. As she was undressing, however, she noticed a letter on the bed and instantly saw that it was from Tony, who had put his name and address on the envelope. Her mother must have left it there, having decided not to mention it. She opened it with a feeling close to alarm, wondering for a second if there was anything wrong with him, relieved when she read the opening sentences that declared his love for her and emphasized how much he missed her. As she read the letter, she wished that she could take it downstairs and read it to her mother. The tone was stiff, formal, old-fashioned. The letter was clearly by someone not used to writing letters. Yet Tony managed to put something of himself into it, his warmth, his kindness, and his enthusiasm for things. And there was also something there all the time in him, she thought, that was in this letter, too. It was a feeling that, were he to turn his head, she might be gone. That afternoon, as she had enjoyed the sea and warm weather, and the company of Nancy and George, and even, towards the end, Jim, she had been away from Tony, far away, basking in the ease of what had suddenly become familiarity. She wished now that she had not married him, not because she did not love him and intend to return to him, but because not telling her mother or her friends made every day she had spent in America a sort of fantasy, something she could not match with the time she was spending at home. It made her feel strangely as though she were two people, one who had battled against two cold winters and many hard days in Brooklyn and fallen in love there, and the other who was her mother's daughter, the Eilish whom everyone knew, or thought they knew. She wished she could go downstairs now and tell her mother what she had done, but she knew she would not. It would be simpler to claim that work called her back to Brooklyn, and right then, when she had returned, to say that she was seeing a man whom she loved and hoped to get engaged to and married to. She would only be home for less than 2 more weeks. As she lay in bed, she thought it would be wise to make the best of it, take no big decisions in what would be an interlude. A chance to be at home like this would be unlikely to come her way again ever. In the morning, she thought, she would get up early and write to Tony and post the letter on her way to work. In the morning, it was hard not to think that she was Rose's ghost, being fed and spoken to in the same way at the same time by her mother, having her clothes admired using the same words as were used with Rose,
and then setting out briskly for work. As she took the same route, Eilish had to stop herself walking with Rose's elegant, determined walk and move more slowly. In the office, Maria Gethings, about whom Rose used to talk, was waiting for her and brought her into the inner sanctum where the cash was kept. The problem was, Maria said, that this was the busy season, and all the lorry drivers and the men working in the mill had done overtime the previous week. They had filled out their hours, but no one had worked out the money they were due, which was set out on a special form and added to their usual wages, which came with another form, a wage slip. They were not even in alphabetical order, Maria said. Eilish said that if Maria left her alone for about 2 hours with all the information about the rates at which overtime was paid, she would work out a system as long as she could ask Maria questions whenever she needed. She said that she would function best on her own, but she would let Maria know if she had even the smallest query. Maria said that she would close the door and leave her undisturbed in this office, mentioning, on her way out, that the men usually came for their wage packets at around 5, and the money was in cash in the safe to pay them with. Eilish found a stapler and began to attach the overtime form for each man to his normal wage sheet. She put them in alphabetical order. When she had all of them done, she went through each overtime form, calculating from the list of rates, which varied considerably depending on years of service and levels of responsibility, how much each man was owed, and then adding this to his wages on the wage sheet so that there was a single figure for each man. She wrote this figure on a separate list, which she then had to tot up to figure out how much money was needed to pay the men everything they were owed. The work was straightforward because the terms were clear, and, so long as she concentrated on making no mistakes in the addition, she thought she would be able to complete the task, provided there were enough loose notes and coins in the safe. She took a short lunch break, insisting to Maria that she would not need any help, just a pile of envelopes and someone to open the safe and run to the bank or the post office for loose change if there was not enough. By 4 o'clock, she had everything done, and the amount of cash used up equaled the amount in her original tote. She had given each man a slip in his envelope that included details of the money due, and had also kept a copy of each for the office files. This was the work she had been dreaming about as she had stood on the shop floor in Bartocci's, seeing the office workers walking in and out, as she was telling customers that the sepia and coffee-colored stockings were for lighter skin and the red fox for darker, or as she had sat listening to the lectures and preparing for the exams in Brooklyn College. She knew that once she and Tony were married, she would stay at home, cleaning the house and preparing food and shopping, and then having children and looking after them as well. She had never mentioned to Tony that she would like to keep working, even if just part-time, maybe doing the accounts from home for someone who needed a bookkeeper. In Bartocci's, she did not think any of the women in the office were married. She wondered, as she came to the end of her day's work at Davis's, if maybe she could do the bookkeeping for the company that Tony was going to set up with his brothers. As she thought about this, she realized that she had forgotten to write to him that morning, and resolved that she would make time that evening and write to him then. On Sunday, just after lunch, with the weather still warm, George and Nancy and Jim pulled up in front of her house on Frary Street. Jim held the back door of the car open for her while she got in. He had a white shirt on with the sleeves rolled up. She noticed the black hair on his arms and the whiteness of his skin. He was wearing hair oil. She thought that he had made a real effort in how he dressed. As they left the town, he spoke to her quietly about how the pub had been the previous night, and how lucky he was that, even though his parents had made it over to him, they were still willing to work there when he wanted to go out. George said that Curlicloe might be too crowded, and he thought they should go to Cush Gap instead and make their way down the cliff. This was where Eilish had come with Rose and her brothers and her parents when they were children, but she had not been there for years nor thought about it. As they drove through Blackwater Village, she almost pointed out the places she knew, such as Mrs. Davis's pub where her father had gone in the evenings, or Jim O'Neill's shop, but she stopped herself. She did not want to sound like someone who had come back home after a long time away, and, she thought, this was something that she might never see again on a summer Sunday like this, but for the others it was nothing, just a decision George had made to go to a quieter place. She was sure that if she began to talk about her memories of this place, they would notice the difference. Instead, she took in each building as they drove up the hill before the turn to Ballyconiger, remembering things that had happened. Small outings to the village with Jack,
or a day when their cousins, the Doyles, had come to visit. This made her silent and made her feel withdrawn from the ease and the quiet sense of comfort and cheer in the car as it turned left and made its way along the narrow, sandy lane to Cush. Once they had parked the car, George and Nancy walked ahead towards the cliff, leaving Jim and Eilish walking behind. Jim was carrying his own togs and towel, as well as her bag with her swimsuit and towel. When they came halfway down the lane, they stopped for a moment at Cullen's house, in front of which Jim's old teacher, Mr. Redmond, was sitting wearing a straw hat. He was clearly on his holidays.
"This might be the only summer we'll get, sir," Jim said.
"Best take full advantage of it, so," Mr. Redmond replied.
Eilish noticed that his speech was slurred. As they moved on, Jim said in a low voice that Mr. Redmond was the only teacher he had ever liked, and it was a pity he had had the stroke.
"Where's his son?" Eilish asked.
"Eamon? He's studying, I'd say. That's what he usually does."
When they came to the bottom of the lane and peered over the edge of the cliff, they saw that the sea below them was calm, almost smooth. The sand close to the water's edge was a dark yellow. There was a line of seabirds flying low over the waves, which seemed barely to swell before they broke quietly, almost noiselessly. There was a vague mist that masked the line between the horizon and the sky, but otherwise the sky was a pure blue. George had to run down the last stretch of sand at the gap in the cliff. He waited for Nancy to follow and held her in his arms. Jim did the same, and Eilish found that, when he caught her, he held her in an embrace that was almost too close, and he did this as though it was something they were used to doing. She shivered for a second at the thought of Tony seeing her now. They spread two rugs out on the sand as Jim took off his shoes and socks and went down to test the water, returning to say that it was almost warm, much better than the previous day, and he was going to change and go in for a swim. George said he would go with him. The last to get down in the water, they agreed, would have to buy dinner. Nancy and Eilish put on their swimsuits but stayed sitting on the rugs.
"They're like a pair of children sometimes," Nancy said as they watched George and Jim and